Thanks for downloading show 98 of the C-Suite podcast, the second in our special series of episodes that we're recording in partnership with the European PR agency Taito and their own Without Borders podcast, where we are interviewing leaders of unicorn companies to find out about the key issues, pain points and challenges that startups face and how they can address them with a strategic approach to marketing and communications.
I didn't know this. I was doing this under false pretenses and that we were promoting Taito PR.
Ah, right.
Whoever Taito PR is.
Well,
you conned me into this. Conned yet again.
Conned again. Now, I was hoping you were going to behave yourself after.
That's also under false pretenses.
I guess we're sponsoring this. We kind of like want to.
Oh, you're the sponsor. How much are you paying for this?
Not enough. Yeah. Believe me, not enough. So once again, he's managed to interrupt me on my intro as he did back in Cannes last year. So I should introduce the fact that I'm at the offices of S4 Capital and we're here to chat to the group's chairman.
Just when we
chairman.
Start the podcast, the drills start.
I know. Yeah. That's all right. Right. We'll work our magic. And
sound engineer is fine.
We'll get rid of that. So the person who you can hear interrupting me once again is Sir Martin Sorrell, the group's chair. And I'm sat with Taito.
It's not a group, by the way. It's a company.
A company. I do apologise. The company's chair. I'm sat with Taito's founder, Brendan Craigie, who I am hosting these unicorn interviews together with. Now, quick introduction. S4 Capital PLC, if you don't know, is a media company focused on building a modern digital advertising and marketing platform for global-minded clients, and in 2018 merged with Media Monks, its content practice, and Mighty Hive, its programmatic practice, and went on to add seven, is that correct?
No, it's actually up to nine.
Nine for the content programmatic and data companies to both
six,
practices.
Six content and three data and analytics and programmatic.
Fantastic. As I mentioned just before, I met and spoke to Sir Martin out in Cannes Lions back in June last year.
You lived to tell the tale.
We enjoyed it. Now, in November, so since that time and in November, he announced that his group has reached US dollar unicorn status with a market cap of over $1.2
billion. 1.3 as of today.
1.3?
Yes.
We are getting news as it comes in.
Over £1 billion. So we're now a sterling unicorn.
Right.
But very verifiable fact, because there's a market that establishes a value.
Right. So on that note, yes. First question then.
I gave you a good lead in there.
Yeah. Because obviously when we set up this series that myself and Brendan are doing, most descriptions of unicorns state that they're privately owned businesses rather than publicly. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are some definitions that just say it's a company worth $1 billion or pounds. But does that definition matter to you? Because you were quite clear in making that point.
It was a nice sort of hook to hang on. The progress that we made in we came to the market when we injected S4 Capital into what was a shell company called Derriston, which is a standard listing on the London Stock Exchange. I think it was on September the 17th of 2018. So we've been going at this for about 18 months, and about 15 months, after 15 months, we got to dollar unicorn status. So that was a nice thing to say. I mean, whether it has any, it has veracity because there's a market value, whereas a lot of the claimed unicorn valuations, as you said, private valuations, and they're pretty meaningless. They're extrapolations of minority funding. If you get somebody to invest at a fancy valuation and buy 2% of the company, you then extrapolate that by 50 times to get the market cap. And I think that's sometimes a bit misleading. We're running at the rate of about, if you pro forma all the things we've done, at about $400 million of revenue and about $100 million of EBITDA before holding company costs or company costs. And, I think it gives us a peg to hang on. It was a target. It was a sort of a validation of the first year that we'd been going. And, most of people didn't think that we would get to this sort of scale this quickly. We're in 30 countries. We have 2,350 people. I was in Amsterdam earlier this week. I used to think of Amsterdam actually being about 500 people of the 2,350, but we're growing at such a rate there. Our organic growth rate is 45%. I'm not talking about deals. I'm talking about organic growth, so like-for-like growth. And, Amsterdam will be up to about 600 or 700 in very short order. We have a new building that we're moving into in Hilversum, which is a suburb of Amsterdam, and a new building that we just moved into in Amsterdam. So we'll have two buildings, and we'll have consolidated four or five businesses in Amsterdam into those two buildings. So it's quite exciting what's happening there. And the vibes and the mood music is very strong. And we have a lot of opportunity there. And similarly, in Silicon Valley, we have a similar concentration of about 500 people. So we've got 1,000 out of the 2,350 in two centres, Amsterdam, which is good for Brexit, and a good capital. I think it's one of the capitals of Europe, probably the capital that's gaining most from Brexit. And then we have Silicon Valley, which, you know, from our point of view, given the fact we're just solely a digital company, you described us as a media company, we're basically a pure digital play. Given the fact that that's where our focus is, obviously Silicon Valley is critical.
Has that met with your expectations when you set it up? The growth where you've got
well,
to...
you know, it's like people said it when I was at Saatchi's or at WPP, you know, what's the growth ambition? And it would be arrogant to sort of say that you have an ambition. And I think a lot of this is it's not luck. You make your own luck. My dad used to say you make your own luck through what you do. But, you know, we didn't have a specific target. We didn't say we want to get to X in terms of revenue or EBITDA by the end of December 19, or that we didn't say we want to get to unicorn say status. But, you know, I think we're pleasantly surprised by the progress that we've made. And I think, coming back to your original question, the suggestion of unicorn status, whether it is meaningful or not, it means something to people's minds. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, US has the largest number of unicorns, followed by the UK, followed by Israel, and would you believe Amsterdam is number four? It was GP Bullhound or Jeggy Clarity, one of the two. I think it was GP Bullhound, actually, who does this annual analysis. And it was quite interesting that Amsterdam has this. So we've got two of the top four. We have large concentrations, Silicon Valley and Amsterdam. So for us, as a purely digital business, it's really a good structure, actually excellent structure.
Can I ask you a question, Sir Martin, about the point you said about saying with Amsterdam being good for Brexit?
Yeah.
Is that like a perception thing, or is that a very real issue?
That's reality. I mean, yeah. I was there, we had a dinner with some of the... Media Monks people and Mighty High people actually in Amsterdam, and they were saying how it's a good indicator of what's happening, how cost of housing, expenses, and there's a bit of inflation there. And the reason is that there are a lot of companies, you know, people talk about Paris, they talk about Berlin, they talk about Frankfurt, they talk about Milan, they talk about Madrid. But I think actually the city that's probably, it's very cosmopolitan, it's well located physically, geographically, it has a good airport, Schiphol, which, you know, is a big airport.
Yeah.
It's a good hub. No, what I was getting at was that it's benefiting because I think a significant number of companies are now starting to locate their international or European operations there.
Right,
okay. And if the Prime Minister, Rutte, who's an ex-Unilever guy, actually, took off the cap on banking salaries or bonuses or whatever it is, and was probably a bit more aggressive, they would grow even faster. Now, there's a big question about the environmental impact of that and the ESG impact of it, because it's a small country. I think Amsterdam's population is about 900,000. So it's not a big city.
Yeah.
So I think people are a little bit worried about, and this is a big issue, that if they take the caps off on compensation or whatever it is in the banking industry, or the levies off, that's going to cause environmental decay.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, it's a small country. Holland's not a big country, but you know, it has Unilever is in Rotterdam. I mean, you've got Booking.com there. I mean, it's really interesting companies.
I just want to go back to
Heineken there. I mean, it's interesting capital.
Just want to go back to the group structure. You started talking about how many acquisitions you've made and how many people you've
got. We don't make acquisitions, we make mergers. We're looking for people. It's a really important point. We're looking for people who want to buy into what we're doing, who philosophically are aligned, that are not looking for to sell out,
okay,
but are looking to buy in. So the first first sentence of every conversation is, if you want to sell, don't come to us.
Yeah.
If you want to sell, go to Dentsu or WPP or Omnicom, right, or whatever it happened to be. If you want to buy into an approach where we're trying to build, we may be successful, we may not be successful, a new age, new era company, you know, this is for you. And that's really everything we've done, and we've done 11 things, including Media Monks and Mighty Hive, in the last year and a bit. Everything we've done has been premised on that basis, with one exception, Caramel Pictures, which was an assets purchase. It was a robotic studio that takes wonderful film of food and drink and works for all the big package goods companies. As Victor Knapp, who's one of the principals at Media Monk, says, we merged with more robots than we did people. But it's a phenomenal facility. In fact, we used it earlier this week. I was involved in a presentation. We actually did. They're absolutely superb technically. And so that was the only thing that we did which could be described as an acquisition.
Well, the point I was leading to is that on the website, it talks about like number of countries, number of people, but then it clearly states one unitary structure.
Yes, and then we think earnouts create fragmentary structure. I mean, and I've been credited wrongly with devising earnouts. It probably was Nathaniel Rothschild at the Battle of Waterloo. But it... You know, what we're trying to do is to build a unitary company. So everything we've done, with the exception of Caramel, everything we've done has been on the basis of half shares, half cash. So people, the entrepreneurs, are totally entitled to capitalize on their hard work and get secure a little bit more security. But the other half of the consideration is stock, where there are lockups, and we're in it together. And so it is genuinely... Yeah, I was talking to somebody at Dentsu, who'd worked at Dentsu earlier this week, and she said, you know, they talk about unitary and they talk about one P&L, and it's complete nonsense because everybody is just focused on their individual piece. And that is the problem with the holding companies, that and particularly when you do earnouts, I mean, people are just focused on their little piece of it, running it autonomously and to the detriment of the whole. And I know that, you know, at WPP, horizontality, which was a terrible word, and which I was partly, if not wholly, responsible for, I know that that's been banned as a part of the vocabulary. But that does get to the heart of the matter, because every one of the companies, including WPP, are trying to get people to think as one firm. The problem is the execution can be too fast, which I believe Publicis is doing too quickly. They're destroying more value than they create. They destroy Saatchi, Burnett and BBH, they maintain Publicis, they maintain Sapient, and they destroy LBI and Digitas and Rosetta and Razorfish. Now, do I think that, you know, the power of one is a bad concept? No, I think it's the right concept. Do I think being one firm is the wrong concept? No, it's the right concept. But when you have these traditional assets, and when you stick Wunderman in front of Thomson, you destroy Thomson. When you stick VML in front of Y&R, you destroy Y&R. And arguably, Thomson and Y&R, although they may have analog connotations, are the stronger brands. So I'm not saying that these decisions are easy. They're very difficult. And it's very easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize. But, you know, Omnicom, I saw somebody from an Omnicom agency just recently, and he said it's a ticking time bomb. Exact words were ticking time bombs. It's just waiting to explode because they're not doing as much strategically as he thought, and many people inside the company feel they need to do. Now, the irony of that is Omnicom does better. Their execution is brilliant. They have great agencies, maybe agencies that are more analog than digital, but they do have great agencies, and they execute well. IPG executes well. As well, you know, the fastest growing in the last quarter of the holding company is growing at 3%. And what people say is, I think with IPG, I think Omnicom and IPG's advantage is they're based in America. Their CEOs sit in America, one in New York, one in Palm Beach. And they sit there and they're, you know, in the what is unarguably the most important market still in the world, at 22 trillion or whatever it is out of 75 trillion. The Chinese are coming up fast at about 14 trillion. I think it was the last IMF estimate of the Chinese GDP. But, you know, on a per capita basis, America soars ahead. So they sit in America. the CEOs of WPP and Publicis sit in London and Paris. And whilst one can argue from a time zone point of view that may be a good place to run a global business, I don't think from a client point of view it is. And you know, when I was trying to run WPP, you know, if you travelled, if you spent a day or 2 days travelling from New York to Boston to Detroit to Chicago and Washington DC, you could cover in theory about 2/3 of WPP's clientele. So the heart of the business, whether we in Britain like it or not, is still America. And, you know, China coming up rapidly, Japan important, Germany important, all these other markets very important. But essentially, America, and with President Trump, you know, he's good for business. Whatever people say about him, he's good for business. You know, he reduces tax, he reduces regulation, spends money on infrastructure. So America is going to become disproportionately more important.
Have you met him?
Yeah, I some time ago, but I did, yeah.
And what was he like? Just as
he was fine. Yeah. He was fine. He was at a wedding.
So, but just
he was happy. It was.
But just on that point then, in terms of, you know, talking about all those different other groups, how much of your time do you spend looking at what they're doing compared to focusing on all these other groups that you were just
With the direct competition we have, I mean, I suppose the direct competition is Fimalac, the French company, which acquired Jellyfish. So that's the nearest direct competitor. You then go beyond that to the holding companies who claim they do what we do. We would say they don't, but they would claim they do. And then you have the accounting, the ex-accounting companies, the, you know, the Accentures and Deloitte Digitals, which are a big, you know, Accenture is a huge company. It's 125 billion market cap last time overlooked, 45 billion of revenue. Interestingly, Group M on its own is bigger than Accenture, which is quite an interesting point because its billings are 50 billion. But, you know, they're big companies and they have their big beasts to feed. And very difficult, I think, to win. They have to win big projects, and not the sort of projects we're interested in. So we do compete against Accenture and Deloitte. You know, at the moment, we're head-to-head with Accenture on a couple of things. One of our presentations in Latin America, so one of the sales meetings we had as Circus got together with Media Monks was a great slide saying Accenture, Media Monks 4, Accenture nil. There apparently have been 4 presentations which our lads and lasses claim to have beaten Accenture. So
we can include that in this podcast, can we?
Well, you know, if there's anybody out there from Accenture who wants to argue with us on that, we'll see. But no, I look, that's the competition. But it really, in terms of head to head, it's more around Fimalac, I think, there, and Jellyfish. But they're really on the media side of the business. They have a content operation, but you know, we're more and more content than programmatic. We're about running a 70% content now and 30% programmatic. We're running 70% the Americas, North and South America, 20% Western Europe and 10% Asia. I wanted to get that to 40-20-40. And the content side, you know, we'll probably try and bring the media side up. We're looking at something at the moment which will increase the media proportion probably to around about 40. 35, 40. So I want to balance the group a little bit more to programmatic and data and analytics, and I want to balance the group a little bit more to Asia Pacific. I worry about Western Europe. I mean, Western Europe as a proportion of worldwide GDP has shrunk over the last few years, and I think we'll continue to do so. So we have to see.
One of the things, Martin, just looking back yeah. over how you communicate around yeah. S4, you're very, you know, succinct and you know, you have a number of sort
Last
of statements.
Thing, nobody's ever said
well,
I was succinct.
Yeah, there's kind
I was going to say, we've been talking for 2 weeks. We've been talking for 20 minutes. We've only done 2 questions.
A lot of the coverage around what you've been saying, there's a lot of repetition around sort of very simple, clear descriptions of what you're trying to do in terms of a unitary structure, faster, better, cheaper, digital only, and it's something that comes through very clearly in terms of, and I just wondered, do you put a lot of thought into that, or, you know, in terms of like making sure that you're being really clear and consistent about what you're talking about?
Well, I don't know whether you put a lot of thought into it or not. I mean, when we started, put a lot of thought into what the strategy should be, you know, purely digital, because that's where the growth is. That holy trinity model of first-party data driving content and programmatic, faster, better, cheaper, what our new colleagues Juan and Lanya Zambrano at Firewood call speed, quality and value. You know, speed plus quality equals value. And you can have all three. You know, a lot of people say you have to do two or three, and I agree with them. You can have all three. It's a slightly more elegant way of putting it. And the fourth principle, unitary structure, not a fragmented structure. But, you know, we thought clearly about that. We've tried to... I think the answer to your question is try and simplify it. You know, there's the two-second ads that, that Media Monks created for L'Oreal in Italy on the back of the insight from Facebook that women spend 1.7 seconds on average looking at a post, and created a two-second ad around... for celebrities, not celebrities, non-celebrity influencers with different skin tones, different hair colours, and created two-second ads. I mean, the normal reaction of an agency would be able to create a 15, 30-second or 60-second TV ad.
2 seconds, yeah.
So two-second ads. And you know, if you think that's wrong, if you think about the Brexit campaign, you know, take back control, you know, concentrating on Brexit. These are the best examples of two-second campaigns, and two-second ads work. You know, these are very simple messages that resonate in a world which is 24/7. And our model of Holy Trinity is an iterative model. It's not a tentpole model where big ideas, again, don't get me wrong, or, you know, people think misinterpret this. This is not that creative or big ideas is not important. They are essential. They are central. But it's the way you execute them. And, you know, tentpole campaigns may not be. I mean, when it looks at the Super Bowl ads and you look at the Oscar ads and you look at the World Cup ads and you look at the Olympic ads, an awful lot of time and effort and energy and creative talent goes into it. And some of it may not be worth the effort that was put into it.
Yeah.
And it may be more about aggrandizement rather than it being effective, either in brand building or in activation. So I think you have to think carefully about
it. And I think coming from your past role where you were representing, you know, one of the largest, most established...
The largest. Not anymore. It's number two to Omnicom. Omnicom has a higher market capitalization.
Right. Than WPP. And now you're kind of playing this role of, like, disruptor. Have you found the role? Well, you are
we are a disruptor. I would say we're more disruptor than disrupted. Although at some point in time we'll become disrupted too.
I'm guessing that's kind of fun. But putting that to one side, have you had to adapt your approach as the kind of like the figurehead communicating around what you're doing? Do you have a different style to before?
I'm not conscious of sort of adapting the style. I mean, I think that's probably, I mean, it might be so, but I haven't thought about it that way. I mean, we focus clearly on different things. I think, I've had three sort of iterations, Saatchi, WPP, and S4. Saatchi's was about globalization purely. WPP was about continuation of globalization and the foothills of technological development, and S4 is purely about technology, and that may demand different styles, but I'm not conscious of it. So all I'm conscious of it is trying to explain simply, which is what we tried to do at WPP. I mean, WPP gets indicted frequently, and that may be because of the new management wishes to try and justify its own strategy, whatever strategy there is there, by saying it became overcomplicated. And, you know, what is it? It's simplicity probably is the hobgoblin of small minds. And you can't, there aren't neat solutions in our business. It is inherently messy. You know, good people are inherently difficult to manage or bring together. I mean, average people, I used to say this all the time, and it used to get me into trouble because... when you say that, you know, good people are difficult to manage and average people are easy to manage, average people become difficult in order to prove that they're good, or to try and prove that they're good. So it defeats the purpose. But, you know, I do believe that. Mm. And I don't think there are... You know, for example, I'll give you a very good example. WPP sold its interest in Globant, which is right in the sweet spot of what WPP is trying to do. I mean, for example, yesterday, I'm interested because I'm still a shareholder in WPP. And, you know, they bought this Floridian e-commerce Amazon company agency, Wunderman Thompson. So they buy that and they sell 20% of Globant. The loss in value on that 20% stake in Globant, I was doing the calculation a couple of days ago, because they sold at 52 and Globant is now about 125, is $500 million. So $500 million of value has been lost. And as a shareholder, I find that, I'm sure the chairman of WPP doesn't even know that he'd lost $500 billion on it. But I would urge him to go and calculate it. And that was because somebody somewhere said, let's just get rid of it, without thinking through quite what they were getting rid of. Yeah. Now, there may have been, it may well have been a good idea to sell 60% of Kantar, but to sell 20% of Globant, which is right in the sweet spot of what WPP is trying to do, was just a patent nonsense. Mm. I described it as criminally negligent, and I say again on this podcast, it is now doubly criminally negligent. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's because of the... I was talking to somebody last night about it. Why did they make that decision? And it was because they made a blanket decision. And decisions are never like that. You can't make blanket decisions, particularly in our business, because it's inherently a messy business because it involves people.
Yeah.
You know, our business is about people, and it's about motivating and incentivizing and managing people, the good people being difficult to manage, the average people probably being easier to match them, put it like that. So forgive the rant. No, I think that's an important point.
That's interesting. Yeah. But how does that conflict work then in terms of if you're a shareholder, still a shareholder at WPP, but you're...
I'm by nature a collector. So I remember Norton Simon, who was a... If there's anybody listening to this podcast, they won't know who Norton Simon was, but he built a big food company. He was a big art collector, rather like Charlie Saatchi. And Norton Simon said, you know, collecting is a disease. You know, you never know when to sell. So I'm diseased.
How important is PR to build S4 Capital, bearing in mind, because obviously you're at events and you're talking about S4 Capital, you know, regularly, but how does that, where does the importance lie with that and then the ensuring that you've got your companies like Media Monks, etc., getting their share of voice as well?
Well, they do a very good job. I mean, just today I saw an email that, you know, they've Media Monks have boosted significantly their communications staff across the globe. And that's part of, you know, because Media Monks has gone from, I think when they became part of the group in, or the company in July of 18, they were about 625 people. Today, they're about 1,850. So they've sort of tripled in size by number of people within, you know, 18 months, just over 18 months. So, you know, that's one of the good things is when your top line is growing by 45% and the industry in which you're operating is growing by 20%, you almost don't have the time to spend the money to catch up. The reverse is also true, is that when, you know, Publicis in Q4 of last year shrunk by about 5%, that's digital business and it's analog business. So the analog business probably shrank more than 5%. Do you think that within the agencies they're cutting their costs, or the creative directors or the account directors or the planners are cutting their salaries by 5%? No, of course not. So you get an imbalance inside the company, which is exacerbated by the varying growth rates. And the simple fact of the matter is that why I'm very focused on purely digital is because that's where the growth is. Mm. And that's where I see the potential. And, you know, I think... You can make the argument we're averagely intelligent. I actually think we're better than average, but let's say we're averagely intelligent. We will do better pushing on an open door. It will be tough. You know, it's Warren Buffett's saying about when good management meets a bad business, the bad business wins.
And what about your role as a spokesperson then for the for the business, bearing in mind...
Well, you know, Pete, Pete Kim at Mighty Hive, Chris Martin at Mighty Hive, Victor and Wes at Media Monks are equally loquacious.
But you must be getting called... I mean, obviously, we've grabbed you for an hour today, but you must be getting called upon all the time. There's conferences you're at constantly. How much does that then impact on actually running and building the business as well?
Well, you have to balance it. It's difficult, and you have to balance it. But you have to... You know, we've created a brand from nothing. We started, you know, literally in this office with one person in June or July or whatever it was of 2018. Media Monks became part of the business in July of 18, and then Mighty Hive on Christmas Eve of 18. Those were the two first big moves, or the two pivot points, if you like, that we've built on. So you have to balance it, and it's not easy. But you know, I spend about, I would say, it's a bit different to WPP. That was about a third clients, third internal, a third external, doing stuff like this and the shareholders and things. I would say it's probably skewed a bit more now, maybe 50-60% with sort of client and client things, and maybe of the other 40%, 20 on internal and 20 external.
Okay. I'm conscious of time because obviously we've only got you for about another 10 minutes. But go on, sorry,
Brendan. I was just going to say, in terms of that communication side of things, has it something that's always come quite natural to you, or have you, was there a point when you weren't very good at it and you actually had to...
No, I'm not conscious of it. And people will say he wasn't very good at it. They'll probably say he isn't very good at it now. So I'm not conscious of it. I think if you're looking, you know, you just try and respond in a natural, not forced way.
We're still battling away over the builders next door. We've just got a few more questions, which we're asking some of which we're asking to all our unicorn leaders. One of which is, what's been the biggest communications challenge you've faced since the launch of S4 Capital?
Well, I think, you know, we've been establishing a brand. I mean, obviously, Media Monks had a following. Mighty Hive had a following. I think, you know, if you ask the leaders of those two pillars of our business, the content practice and the programmatic practice, they would say... You know, they have far more brand recognition today than they had before. So, you know, we've had to sort of launch a brand, and I think we launched it successfully. I think we have brand trial. The opportunity for us is to get to move from trial to what I would call conversion at scale. You know, we call them whoppertunities, whoppers. you know, we have one very large client as a proportion of our $400 million of revenue, and we've got what we have to do is to demonstrate that we can do what we're doing at scale. So the Holy Trinity model, which really is part of digital transformation or business transformation, whatever you want to call it, that's the business that we're really in. So as we were talking about it last week at our board meeting in New York, you know, when we talk about the Holy Trinity model and we talk about first-party data driving digital advertising content and programmatic, that really is the activation end of, or activation part, or part of the activation of digital transformation. So increasingly, that's where our business is going to be positioned. And, you know, we compete. I went through the competition. Directly, we compete with a business that is smaller than ourselves. Indirectly, we compete with holding companies that are bigger. And indirectly, we compete with consultancies, which are even bigger than they are. So we have to fashion what we do. We have to be the disruptor. We have to be the motor torpedo boat. You know, we have to be the Israel or the Singapore or the UK now, post-Brexit, rather than the US or China or Brazil or India. So it's a very different, you know, and it's very different, obviously, to trying to run WPP.
And on that point, actually, you've been quite outspoken about WPP.
Yeah. I'm a shareholder, I'm entitled to.
Do you think that...
Like, the loss of value on Globant. Yeah.
But do you think that founders of other companies that are kind of disrupting industries should be more confident in criticizing the competition?
Well, I'm not criticizing the competition because they're not direct competition. And by nature and scale, they're very different to us. I mean, their strategy, if you can divine it, is different. No, listen, I, I think perfectly entitled to express a view. I express a view on succession there, and I don't think the structure. You now have you have Mark Read there, you have Andrew Scott, you have John Rogers. I mean, who's just moved in there. You know, who was in the race to be CEO of Sainsbury. And now he's joined WPP. So you have sort of three people who are whose lines of activity sort of overlap. I don't know quite how they're going to divide it up. But, you know, Andrew, you know, he's a very talented guy who seems to be doing more on the M&A front. Mark is, you know, seems to be more involved with clients. Mm. And John Rogers, you know, so here is a guy who was going to become a CEO who now has gone back in inverted commas. I mean, I think WPP is a bigger company, but has gone back to being a CFO. So there's going to be a lot of overlapping areas in the executives, in the C-suite. Yeah. It's not clearly demarcated. Mm. I think probably there are two jobs there and the three people. So just as an observer, I think that's... Yeah, an interesting situation, but time will tell.
Well, talking of time, nicely, we've got about 5 minutes left with you. We've got a few more questions. So I just want to just quickly on these. And obviously, you were at Davos just recently. You've talked about the need for technology companies to exercise their power responsibly. Do you believe there is a greater onus on tech founders today to act?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, whether it's issues of climate change, and Satya Nadella really took the agenda, I think, at Davos, in a way, certainly the public agenda. I think the private agenda was more around what's the relationship between America and China, and, you know, that's a deteriorating relationship, which I think is critical. You know, as critical as climate change. I'm not saying climate change isn't critical, it is, but the two are really important. They're interlinked because China, given its size, is bound to be the biggest polluter and emitter of carbon. So in a sense, they're linked. But Satya took the lead by saying, you know, we're going to go for not just zero emissions, we're going to go for negative to make up for what we did in the past. Yeah. So he set a very, very high bar, and I think it's a good example. Now, Google now have gone have made it clear they're going to eliminate third-party cookies over the next 2 years. We don't quite know how that's going to play out, but it has a lot of serious implications for the industry. So, and why did they do that? I think part of it was to do, I don't know, but I guess part of it is to deal with the privacy issues. It's going to eliminate a number of publishers. So there will be a further debate about whether, you know, the too few publishers, you know, is journalism being crushed? So that'll be another part of it. A number of the people who relied on third-party cookies are going to go to the wall. We've seen a very significant impact, for example, on the market capitalization of Criteo as a result. The Criteo always seems to take the brunt of any change of that nature, or even if it does affect companies like the Trade Desk and others. So there's a lot of things. So I think, but what you're seeing is the tech companies embrace this. It might be because they're worried about the privacy debate. It may be they're worried about brand safety. It may be they're worried about interference in elections. It's probably to do with the fact that they're worried about regulation. I mean, now in America, the regulator will review even small tech transactions, not even ones that technically it should. So everybody, all the regulators are gunning in Europe and in America on a state-by-state basis and on a federal basis. They're gunning for the tech companies because, you know, with size comes responsibility, and, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, Google are all trillion, Apple are all trillion-dollar companies. You know, there is a bigger company, and that's Aramco, but you know, I think Amazon is now up to 1.3, 1.4 trillion. So these are very big companies, and with power comes responsibility. So I think they're starting to see they have to exercise responsibility. I mean, Google and Facebook, and they don't get much credit for this, and I think this is wrong. I think they should be given credit for it. They've hired, I think, Google 10,000 people, Facebook 30,000 plus, I think it's 38,000 people. You've seen it's had impact on their margins. I mean, their costs have gone up as a result, and their margins. And they're trying to monitor much more the editorial content. You know, are they media companies? Are they tech companies? I happen to think they're media companies. They've always protested that they're tech companies, but I think they're beginning to act like media companies and make the balanced decision. And I think the reason they're doing that is because they've been phenomenally successful. I don't see them, by the way, being eclipsed. The only company I've seen in the last year or so that really has got momentum is ByteDance, TikTok. And I'm told ByteDance has $20 billion of ad revenues, and TikTok within it is $7 billion. So that's the only one that's moved the needle beyond Google, Facebook and Amazon and Tencent, Alibaba continuing to march forward. And when they introduced GDPR here, the intention was to, you know, to put a limit on the big boys, the big girls. What it's done is given them a stronger position. And I think, you know, Google's decision on third-party cookies will make Google stronger, not going to make Google weaker.
We've got time for one last question because we are on a very tight timescale.
I'm not sure you're going to have an opinion on this, Martin, because you've
Don't ask the question.
Well, you've talked a lot about being not particularly conscious of your communications approach. But one question we've been asking all of the unicorn leaders is, if you were to go back in time and give your old self some advice on how they could do a better job in communicating, what advice would you give?
No, this is not good for you. I don't think surrounding yourself with advisors is necessarily the best thing. I think the advice tends to be err on the side of caution and not saying and not opining. Keep your head down. Don't put your head over the parapet. And, you know, it's very simple. If somebody's going to write something negative, and let's say it's going to be a minus 10, if you speak to the person before they write it, you probably can make it a minus 9 or a minus 8 or a minus 7. You might not be able to make it a 0 or a plus 10. But, you know, if you don't speak, you don't. So I think, you know, hiding, you know, the classic response, you know, on a Friday afternoon, well, it used to be the case, you know, you had Friday afternoon deadline and the reporter would ring you up and the PA would say, you know, he's in a meeting or he's traveling or, you know, whereas he's hiding under the desk. I don't think that works.
No.
So I think you just have to be responsive, and some people disagree with that. And, you know, that much overused word authentic, just say what you feel.
No, I think that's great advice, because otherwise I think you need personality.
That doesn't mean that advisors are not valuable. They are.
Yeah.
But it means that it tends to hem you in and tends to make you overcautious.
Yeah.
That would be, for what it's worth,
I think that's great.
So anybody on this podcast that's listening, and just to prove, I'm just trying to find out.
You're going to be bombarded tomorrow.
Martin at s4capital.com. All those people are listening. Just send me a one-line email.
You're testing us out.
And I will tell Russell and tell our sponsor. We'll find out exactly, because, you know, these are blind podcasts.
That's right. Well, Martin, despite the builders drilling away next door, thank you so
despite
much.
Despite the interruptions.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting us to your office.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. Good luck.
Thank you.
So, Brendan, that's unicorn number 2 in the can. Initial thoughts off the back of that chat?
I mean, it was fantastic, and I just think there's just so much great wisdom in what Sir Martin was saying. I was particularly liked his answer to the last question, because I think that ultimately, as a leader, you need to have a very strong personality and identity that comes through your communications. And yes, advisors can help along the way, but unless you have a very clear idea about how you want to present yourself to the outside world, then it's going to feel soulless. So I thought that was a really great point.
What about right at the start? We were talking about the positioning of a unicorn, obviously, given this is what the series.
Yeah, I think when you're growing a business and you're trying to stand out from the crowd, you're always trying to find points that you can use to kind of add credibility to your success. And in that sense, I think the unicorn moniker is really helpful and kind of just is a great indicator that everyone understands that you're a serious business and you're going places.
Yeah. And so just as a reminder, obviously we're two down, eight to go now. What's your plan for the series and what are you hoping to do with all the content as well afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, this series was inspired by just personal experience of kind of working with lots of CEOs and founders of technology companies and just sort of experiencing a sense of being maybe slightly uncertain around how they should be approaching issues to do with communications. And so we really thought that, you know, that we wanted to kind of do something to help people that were sort of thinking about the challenges around communications, knowing how important it is to their, you know, their growth and their success. And therefore we wanted to work with you to get a group of people that we think are, you know, have sort of valuable lessons to share, and then to try and capture that.
Yeah. Well, Sir Martin certainly wasn't shy in coming forward with some of his advice and tips. Yeah, I loved it, absolutely loved it. Well, that is actually it for the second episode in this special series. So if you want to find out more about S4 Capital, their website is simply s4capital.com. Of course, if you are a unicorn leader listening to this series and feel we should be interviewing you, please do get your people to speak to our people and we'll try and make it happen. In the meantime, we'd love to hear any comments you have on today's chat, which you can do on our Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram or Twitter feeds. And those are all linked from the top of the website at csuitepodcast.com, where you'll also find all our previous shows and support show notes, plus links to where you can subscribe for automatic downloads of each episode via the likes of Spotify or iTunes. And if you've liked what you've heard, please do give us a positive rating and review. We're also on all your favorite podcast apps, so just search for the C-Suite Podcast and hit subscribe. Just a reminder, you can also subscribe to the Without Borders podcast from our partners at Taito, and all the details for that are on their website. Just head to taitopr.com and click on the podcast link at the top of the nav bar. If you would like to get in touch with this show, you can do that via our contact form at csuitepodcast.com, or you can reach me via Twitter using @RossGoldsmith, or find me on LinkedIn. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.